This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
In today's lecture, Fabian Klose will talk about the history of international politics in the 1990s. Our guest is Professor of International History and Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Cologne. His new book, In the Course of Humanity, A History of Humanitarian Intervention in the Long 19th Century, was recently published by Cambridge University Press. In his new research project, Professor Klose is focusing on international history in the 1990s and the lasting legacy for international politics. During this decade, new visions of global governance emerged, which were based on a redefinition of fundamental principles, such as peace, security, sovereignty, and the idea of responsibility associated with these multilateral approaches. However, far from being linear and triumphal, these developments were overshadowed by mass violence, ethnic cleansing, genocide, and the failures of the international community to prevent them. In the following lecture, Klose will focus on the role of the United Nations and has proclaimed visions for a world order. His talk is entitled The Quest for a New World Order, International Politics Between Visions of Global Governance and Catastrophic Failures in the 1990s.
It's a great pleasure to meet with you to discuss with you some first thoughts of my next research project on the history of international politics in the 1990s. It's a new project, just finishing my English book project on the history of humanitarian intervention in the long 19th century. It means that, to be frank, this new project is at a very early stage. Thus, I will not present thoroughly conceptualized new project or even final research results today, but rather first initial ideas of thinking about and of historicizing the last decade of the 20th century. So being at a very early stage, this is for me a wonderful opportunity to discuss various issues at an early stage with you. And I'm very much looking forward to your comments, remarks, and questions after the lecture. Even though my talk will be concentrated on the end of the 20th century, I would like to start confronting you with a quote from the 19th century I came across working on my last project, and which can be seen as a kind of starting point for thinking about my new project. During the Great Eastern Crisis of 1875 to 1878, and after the Russian declaration of war against the Ottoman Empire, an intense debate among legal scholars emerged discussing the lawfulness of intervention on humanitarian grounds. In this debate, the German scholar Egidius Arndt argued, I quote, "When a government, so acting within the limits of its sovereign rights, violates the rights of humanity, be it by measures contrary to the interest of other states, or be it by excesses of injustice and cruelty, which are deeply wounding to our manners and our civilization, the right of intervention is lawful. For, however, worthy of respect the rights of sovereignty and the independence of states may be, there is something worthy of greater respect still, and that is the right of humanity, or of human society, which must not be insulted. Just as within the state, the freedom of the individual is restrained and must be restrained by the law and by the manners of society, so the individual freedom of states must be limited by the law of human society." End of quote. This is a rather long quote. And with this formula, Arndt provided something like a first general definition of humanitarian intervention, limiting the legal protection of the sovereignty and independence of states by, or I would even say, subordinate it to the law of humanity. Other prominent legal scholars of this time, such as the Belgian Gustave Poulain-Jacquemin or the Swiss Johann Caspar Plautry, supported this legal position. And while reading through these documents, I thought that these deliberations of Hans and his colleagues are indeed remarkable. In a way, they already anticipated in the 1870s a debate which became absolutely crucial in international politics over 100 years later. It was in the 1990s that during the quest for a new world order and under the heading of so-called global governance, the relationship between sovereignty and the laws of humanity was intensively discussed and even became a formative element of this decade of transformation. And allow me this brief remark. It's probably not surprising that I'm making this remark coming from the history of the 19th century. I think looking at this quote and the relation to the 20th century, it might be also a striking argument for the importance of research on the 19th century and to link emerging fields of the 19th century, such as international law or international governance, even closer to contemporary history of the 20th century. At the beginning of the 1990s, to come back to the 20th century, the end of the Cold War, which had dominated international politics for over 40 years, marked a decisive turning point in history. It led to a significant transformation of international order, which some contemporaries interpreted enthusiastically as the beginning of a new and prosperous chapter in human history. Most prominently, US President George H.W. Bush proclaimed in his speech in Congress on September 11, 1990, the beginning of, quote, a new world order, freer from the threat of terror, stronger in the pursuit of justice, and more secure in the quest for peace. Far beyond this rather optimistic proclamation, in reality, however, the quest for a new world order was far from being secure, just, and peaceful. It also did not mark the, quote, end of history, the end point of mankind's ideological evolution and the universalization of Western liberal democracies as the final form of human government, as Francis Fukuyama proclaimed in his article in the National Interest in summer 1989. Far from Fukuyama's proclamation of a glorious victory of economic and political liberalism and his prospect of centuries of boredom at the end of history, the 1990s turned out to be quite different and not boring at all. It became rather an ambivalent, Janus-faced decade marked by very contradictory developments. On the one hand, we witnessed the emergence of visions of global governance, broadly understood as accelerating process of cooperation among transnational actors and international institutions within the framework of commonly agreed rules and regulations. Especially in the realm of the United Nations, these visions became visible in a new agenda for peace and the establishment of the principle of human security as a guiding paradigm to counter common challenges for humanity on a global scale. I personally think that it is still rather surprising that even in very recent publications on the search for a new world order, the United Nations and its visions for global governments are very often missing, but just briefly mentioned. Instead, in these publications, the focus is still mainly of various positions of national governments. In the 1990s, we can identify various attempts to redefine fundamental principles such as peace, security, sovereignty, and to resolve the question of international responsibility to enforce these principles. Some historians and political scientists even regard the 1990s as the new breakthrough of the international human rights regime and as the eroding moment of the distinction between humanitarianism and human rights converging to a common humanities law. I mean, and here I would refer again to the quote at the beginning of Hans, who is talking about the right of humanity. On the other hand, the 1990s saw the emergence of fierce new assertions of nationalism, brutal ethnic, social, and religious strife, threatening the cohesion of states. The dissolution of the Soviet Union led to an explosion of ethnic conflicts and resulted in bloody confrontations in the Caucasus, such as between Armenia and Azerbaijan. In Somalia, the ongoing civil war between various parties led to the breakdown of state authority and a major humanitarian crisis for the civilian population. In the course of the dissolution of Yugoslavia, three severe civil wars were fought in Croatia, Serbia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and the Kosovo between 1991 and 1999, bringing back ethnic cleansing and crimes against humanity to Europe and leaving more than 100 people killed. In Afghanistan, the Taliban achieved decisive victories in the civil war, bringing them to power in 1996 for the first time and enabling them to build up the reign of terror. In Rwanda, the international community stood by in 1994 while an estimated 800,000 Tutsi were killed by their Hutu compatriots within only a few weeks. Thus, despite all idealistic visions of global governance, the decade of the 1990s can also be interpreted as an eruption of mass violence, ethnic cleansing, genocide. A new project seeks to historicize international politics of the 1990s through the lens of visions, debates, practices, and failures of global governance. Over the last 30 years, the issue has been discussed mostly by political scientists, using the concept as a theoretical point of reference for analyzing international relations. Yet, historical scholarship has long neglected this issue. Thus, my aim is to examine the development of the idea of global governments as a specific phenomenon of the 1990s. In other words, did a coherent concept of global governments indeed emerge as a vision for a new world order in this decade? Who supported this idea and for which motives? What were the consequences and the impact of these visions on international politics in the 1990s and beyond? Furthermore, how can we relate these developments to problems and issues of our days, such as most prominently the recent failure of the West in Afghanistan? At this point of my considerations, three key aspects take center stage, and I would like to raise these issues in my lecture today. First, visions of global governance, the United Nations in the 1990s. Second, the 1990s as a testing ground of global governance. And third, the lasting legacy of the 1990s. Allow me to start with my first point. Visions of global governance, the United Nations in the 1990s. The end of the Cold War made it possible and necessary for the United Nations to begin playing a greater role in the sphere of international security and peace, the two main goals according to Article 1, Paragraph 1 of its charter. This moment offered a kind of window of opportunity for the World Organization to rethink its fundamental principles, to develop new concepts, to react adequately to new emerging international challenges, and to develop visions of global governance. In June 1992, UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali made his new agenda for peace public, outlining a new role for the World Organization. He described the end of the Cold War as a unique opportunity to realize the objectives of the UN Charter without being paralyzed anymore by ideological confrontation and to establish, quote, a United Nations capable of maintaining international peace and security, of securing justice and human rights, and of promoting social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom, end of quote. Boutros-Ghali explicitly referred in his agenda to the multi-layered and tangled causes of conflict and insecurity, which went far beyond the traditional notion of war and peace. He identified issues of social and economic underdevelopment, poverty, famine, disease, gross human rights violation as a complex new dimension of insecurity, which would produce millions of refugees and displace millions around the world. In order to tackle these complex intertwined challenges for peace and security, he proposed a much more advanced mechanism to react, which consisted of four central components: preventive diplomacy, peacemaking and peacekeeping, as well as post-conflict peace building. In the notion of Guattari, the time of absolute and exclusive sovereignty of states had passed in an ever more interdependent world. It was now the shared responsibility of individual states, non-governmental organizations, as well as the whole UN system to foster commonly an integrated approach, quote, of human security. Guattari's agenda for peace was a remarkable, however often neglected, document in many respects. It clearly acknowledged the multi-layered entangled causes of conflict and the new dimension of insecurity. It proposed an advanced UN mechanism to react, and finally, it started a reform process in order to transform the United Nations into a leading actor of global governance. Far and foremost, it was an attempt to overcome the dualism of absolute sovereignty in the name of peace and security and international intervention in the cause of human protection, which existed within the UN system since 1945. Interestingly enough, in Guattari's agenda, we find various references to the situation of the United Nations in its founding phase of the 1940s, and suggestion to use the opportunity of the 1990s for significantly advancing the UN system. Preserving international peace and security on the one hand, and protecting human rights and humanitarian needs on the other hand, were now not regarded as different or even rival goals any longer, but as an integrated major common aim of the United Nations. In this respect, the agenda for peace could be interpreted as an important attempt to reconcile and to integrate various aims of the World Organization. However, the agenda for peace was only the starting point. In March 1994, the United Nations published its Human Development Report, which further argued to redefine the notion of security. Security, conventionally interpreted in a narrow sense as the protection of territory against external aggression and of national interest in foreign policy, were thus significantly broadened and transformed. Now centered on the well-being of individuals rather than nation states, the new concept of human security emphasized the links between extreme poverty, violence and armed conflicts, climate change, and other threats to human welfare and fundamental human rights. The concept declared the protection against these threats as the main goal of all international efforts. Understood as a holistic concept, human security consisted of different components, thus bringing together the human elements of security, of development, and of individual rights. Even though it's emphasized the links and overlaps between these elements, the protection of people's basic rights and freedom were still regarded as the first key to human security. A year later, in 1995, this development culminated in the report Our Global Neighborhood by the Commission on Global Governance. This commission, established in 1992 and with full support of Guattari, co-chaired by Swedish Prime Minister Ingvar Carlsson and former Commonwealth Secretary General Sir Sridhar Rampal, gave a standard definition of global governance. And you will see it is admittedly in rather vague terms. I quote, "Governance is the sum of many ways individuals and institutions, public and private, manage the common affairs. It is a continuing process through which conflicting or diverse interests may be accommodated and cooperative action may be taken. It includes formal institutions and regimes empowered to enforce compliance, as well as informal arrangements that people and institutions either have agreed to or perceive to be in their interests, end of quote. In the Commission's interpretation, there was no single model or form of global governance, but it was rather described as a broad, dynamic, complex process of interactive decision to find common solution for the most pressing problems of humanity. Thus, the report directly referred to the agenda of peace and the new approach of human security, and pledged strongly for a leading role of the United Nations in realizing this vision of global governance. Despite harsh criticism from various sides about the vagueness of the concept, and if you read the definition, it's indeed very vague, and the accusation of being only an empty signifier, the concept of global governance under the leadership of the United Nations became part of the mindset in international politics in the 1990s, and was presented as a promising way to build up, quote, a new world. Thus, I would argue at this point that the notion of global governance, even if it in its vague terms, is not only a theoretical frame in political science to analyze international relations, but we have to take it seriously as a historical phenomenon emerging out of the specific situation of the 1990s, and which must be accordingly historicized. However, analyzing UN visions of global governments leads to the much broader question of if and how this concept altered international politics during this decade and how they worked in practice. In other words, which consequences did UN visions of global governance have for the 1990s? Which traces did they leave? This leads me to my second point, the 1990s as testing ground for global governance. In the early 1990s, we indeed recognize a very variable explosion of international interference in various humanitarian crises around the world, beginning with Iraq, continuing with former Yugoslavia and Somalia. During this period, of the World Organization was indeed more active than ever before in its 45 years history, well illustrated in these few exemplary numbers. While between 1948 and 1988, only 15 UN peace missions existed, their number grew significantly to 38 new missions only in the 1990s. Between 1987 and 1994, the number of UN blue helmets were raised from 10,000 to 70,000, and the UN peacekeeping budget from $230 million to $3 billion. Furthermore, it was not only the pure scope, but also the nature of UN missions which changed significantly. The first half of the 1990s witnessed an expansion beyond the traditional Hammarskjöldin model, a significant shift from traditional peacekeeping into the direction of active peace enforcement. Thus, a new UN department, the Department for Peacekeeping Operation, DPKO, was created by UN Secretary General Boutros Ghali in March 1992, actually one of his first decisions after taking office. This department, the DPKO, is now working since January 2019 under its new name, Department of Peace Operation, and with an annual budget of $6.5 billion, it is the largest UN agency by expenditures. If you take the numbers and also the nature of UN missions in the first half of the 1990s, at first glance, this could be all interpreted indeed as a successful implementation or attempt to implement visions of global governments proclaimed by the United Nations. However, if you look closer, this picture is getting blurred and much more ambivalent. The transition from classic Cold War peacekeeping to a policy in the sense of active humanitarian intervention was often accompanied by setbacks and tension, and in the worst case, led to catastrophic failures on the ground. UN Blue Helmets on the spot had to realize, and often in dramatic ways, that the concept of the impartial use of force was completely inadequate to stop gross human rights violations and even genocide. The failure of the UN missions in Somalia, Rwanda, Bosnia-Herzegovina in the early 1990s illustrate this point with sad clarity. The UN and its locally stationed peacekeeping troops proved unable to prevent either the genocide of an estimated 800,000 Tutsi by their Hutu compatriots in Rwanda in 1994, or that of over 8,000 Bosnian Muslims by Serb forces in the so-called safe haven declared by the UN around the town of Srebrenica in 1995. Only within a year after proclaiming its concept of human security, the United Nations experienced two of its most dramatic failures to protect the most fundamental human rights. Even the already mentioned Commission on Global Governments had to admit in its report in 1995 that during its time of working, the world was witnessing ethnic cleansing in the Balkans, brutal violence in Somalia, genocide in Rwanda, in combination with inaction of governments and the United Nations. And I quote of this report, instead of coming together around a common vision of the way forward, the report critically remarked, the world seems in danger of losing its way, end of quote. The World Organization had to realize that its mechanism was not sufficient in practice to protect individuals from the worst human rights violations, such as genocide and ethnic cleansing, crimes against humanity, and that its failure was partly rooted in a philosophy of neutrality and nonviolence wholly unsuited in this new internal conflict scenarios. A critical gap became obvious between the claim of global governments and successful implementation and the instruments to enforce it in humanitarian crises around the world. Additionally, this debate got fueled when, in the case of the emerging humanitarian crisis in Kosovo in 1998, a mandate for intervention was blocked in the UN Security Council, vetoed by Russia and China. As a result, NATO, under the leadership of the United States, militarily intervened without UN mandate in the conflict, which led to the defeat of Yugoslavia and the withdrawal of its troops from the province of Kosovo. Once more, the issue of legality and legitimacy of humanitarian intervention in the context of the existing principle of sovereignty was raised. These debates revealed again the fundamental gap between theoretical concept of sustainable human protection and its practical implementation. In other words, the UN aim of human security did not match with the political realities of its time. Accordingly, we can argue, I think, that the 1990s as a testing ground for global governments left fundamental questions like who, when, how was responsible to protect human security unanswered. Rather, visions of governing globally were accompanied by failures with catastrophic consequences, which brings me to my last point, the legacy of the 1990s. These open questions of who is responsible to intervene, who is responsible to protect human security, and the catastrophic failures of the 1990s can also be interpreted as a catalyst for re-fostering debates on global governance regarding the 21st century. A leading figure in this process was without doubt Kofi Annan, UN Secretary General since 1997. Annan's position was clearly influenced by his own experience as head of the organization's Department of Peacekeeping Operation from 1993 to 1996, when the UN was not able, as mentioned, to prevent the Rwandan genocide and the Srebrenica massacre. influenced by this personal experience, I think you get really a strong sense how much this was influenced reading his biography, which is named or entitled Interventions. Annan strongly pleaded for advancing visions and practices to protect human security effectively. In an interview in September 1990 with The Economist, he argued, I quote, state sovereignty in its most basic sense is being redefined, not least by the forces of globalization and international cooperation. States are now widely understood to be instruments at the service of their peoples, and not vice versa. At the same time, individual sovereignty, by which I mean the fundamental freedom of each individual, enshrined in the Charter of the UN and subsequent international treaty, has been enhanced by a renewed and spreading consciousness of individual rights. When we read the Charter today, we are more than ever conscious that its aim is to protect individual human beings, not to protect those who abuse them, end of quote. In his argumentation, Annan referred to earlier announced concepts such as the Agenda for Peace and Human Security, and pleaded to advance the idea of global governance. On the occasion of the UN Millennium Summit in September 2000, Annan released a report in which he identified the main challenges for international community in the 21st century and tried to sketch out an action plan to address them. These considerations at the dawn of the new millennium clearly reflected the debates of the passing decade. Annan argued for a holistic approach of the United Nations, which should integrate effectively conflict prevention, post-conflict peace building, humanitarian assistance, and development policies. Regarding the effective protection of human security, he not only pushed for the establishment of an international criminal court and the strengthening of international humanitarian law, but also implied a reformed concept of humanitarian intervention. The direct military intervention from outside in the internal affairs of a sovereign state for the purpose of protecting humanitarian norms. And the Secretary General's words did not go unheeded. It was in the reaction to this proposal that the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty, ICISS, a committee of 12 experts from various countries, which had been founded at the suggestion of the Canadian government, started its work already in September 2000 and began to develop concept for human protection. After a year of deliberation, the expert panel delivered its final report entitled The Responsibility to Protect in September 2001. In their report of more than 100 pages, the expert first acknowledged that since the end of the Cold War, the international situation had fundamentally changed and created new challenges for the United Nations in the realm of peace and security. Traditionally, UN peacekeeping strategies created an era of war, mainly between states, for the purpose to monitor and to reinforce ceasefires, were regarded as no longer timely to react adequately to these new challenges. Furthermore, they emphasized the importance of the emerging idea of human security again for providing a conceptual framework for international action. I quote, whether universal, popular or not, there is growing recognition worldwide that the protection of human security, including human rights and human dignity, must be one of the fundamental objectives of modern international institutions, end of quote. Thus, the Commission proposed a redefinition of the principle of sovereignty. Sovereignty, it argued, was to be understood not only as a state's power and right under international law to control its internal affairs as it saw fit, but also entailed an overriding obligation to ensure the protection of individuals in its country. In the case where a state was found no longer to be fulfilling this duty, the ICISS argued the following, I quote, where a population is suffering serious harm as a result of internal war, insurgency, repression, and state failure, and the state in question is unwilling or unable to halt and avert it, the principle of non-intervention yields to the international responsibility to protect. In other words, if and when a state should prove unable to guarantee the protection of its population basic rights, the principle of non-intervention is rendered void and the responsibility to protect passes to the international community. While in an earlier formulation, the concept of humanitarian intervention had been limited to its military dimension, the R2P concept was now seen as a holistic concept consisting of three essential components, namely the responsibility to prevent, the responsibility to react, and the responsibility to rebuild. The ICISS report left no doubt that it regarded prevention as the most important dimension of R2P, which should be always exhausted before the intervention option is taken. One could argue that from the deep crisis of protecting human security in the mid-1990s, a reformed enforcement mechanism emerged, which received international recognition at the 2005 UN summit and was celebrated as a normative breakthrough. How deeply this concept was rooted in the failures of the 1990s becomes obvious when examining the first official application. In the case of Libya, in 2011, Jan Eliasson, UN Deputy Secretary General, justified the international military intervention by arguing that the situation in the North African state constituted a, quote, Srebrenica moment, in which the international community was bound to intervene. Yet, does the lasting legacies of the 1990s really consist in a normative breakthrough of R2P? Can we really speak of lessons learned by Western states from the failures at the end of the 20th century? I think we all have our doubts about this, but already contemporary observers raised already critical voices at the beginning of the new millennium. To give you one example, the German sociologist Ulrich Beck warned already in 2004 that the R2P concept designed as a sustainable way of protecting human security could actually turn into the exact opposite. A legitimation for military intervention around the world, and thus a threat to peace and security. I quote, its effects of humanitarian intervention may be said to resemble those of an erupting volcano covering the world in the fiery lava of armed conflict. It is precisely because enforcing human rights overcomes and must overcome national resistance that the promise of pacification and stability by means of human rights, the perpetual peace heralded by Kant, may so easily lapse into the depacification and destabilization through perpetual wars, end of quote. The military protection of universal human rights and humanitarian needs in an ever increasing numbers of countries and regions, for example, Kosovo, Afghanistan, and in Iraq, was the danger of a throughgoing human rights colonialism and military humanism, the vehicle of which would be UN protectorates. Within the question of global responsibility, so Beck's argument, lay concealed the dangers and temptations of new colonialism plucked in the idea of humanitarian intervention. I guess the background of the recent failures of the West in Afghanistan, I would say that these critical voices of the early 2000s about Western liberal interventionism seems to be rather relevant. Furthermore, many conflicts rooted in the 1990s are still of major international concern nowadays. And I would say that this reminds us of the importance to critically examine international politics in the 1990s with all its ambiguous legacies. Allow me briefly to summarize some key aspects of my new project and by mentioning some challenges I identify at this early stage. The 1990s, I think we can all agree on this, are far from being marked by boredom at the end of history, but the 1990s are an ambivalent and dynamic decade marked by very contradictory development, which are highly relevant for our understanding of our times. In my project, I try or seek to historicize international politics of this decade through the lens of vision, debates, failures, and practices of global governance as a phenomenon emerging out of the specific situation of the 1990s. In doing this, however, I think it is crucial to investigate the historical evolution of this concept beyond and within the 1990s. Going beyond the 1990s means to ask, where and when did the idea of global governments and human security originate? In my opinion, this is closely linked to the history of the United Nations since 1945. Interestingly enough, I've mentioned it during my talk, all the mentioned reports on developing visions of global governments strongly referred to the founding of the World Organization, the high hopes that had been connected to it, and the disappointment that had fallen, just to present the 1990s as a real window of opportunity to reconcile various fundamental UN aims, to redefine the relation of peace, security, and sovereignty, and to develop new concepts to react adequately to new emerging global challenges. Just to give you a last example from the Global Governments report, I quote, 50 years ago, international cooperation, collective security, and international law were powerful concepts. In 1945, world leaders met in San Francisco to sign the United Nations Charter, a document expressing the universal hope that a new era in international behavior and governments was about to begin. The onset of the Cold War did not entirely smooth out its hope, but it's greatly diminished its fulfillment. And also in the other reports, you find always this reference to the 1940s and the founding of the World Organization. Within the 1990s means to ask who supported these new visions of governing globally and with which motives. Here, I would say that the case study of United Germany might be especially worth to examine in more detail. The emergence of visions of global governance coincided with the research for a new and full-fledged German foreign policy after reunification. While Germany was still reluctant to actively participate in military intervention, such as the Iraq War in 1991, it's fundamentally changed its position during the course of the decade and became an active partner in various UN missions around the world. In this respect, participating in endeavors of global governments could be interpreted in the German case as a way of redefining its foreign policy fundamentally and positioning itself as a reliable partner in the emerging new international order. Within the 1990s, however, also means to look at who opposed and criticized these visions and who developed alternative visions of governing globally. Here, especially the relationship between the United Nations and the United States as the last remaining superpower will be of crucial importance, not least for interpreting the time of the 9/11. And I'll leave it with this. Thank you very much for your attention. And as I said before, I'm very much looking forward to your questions and comments. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.